Chapter 10. Lofty, her bearing majestic, whether in movement or repose. Margrave accosted her in some language unknown to me. She replied in what seemed to me the same tongue. The tones of her voice were sweet, but inexpressibly mournful. The words that they uttered appeared intended to warn, or deprecate, or dissuade. But they called to Margrave's brow a lowering frown, and drew from his lips a burst of unmistakable anger. The woman rejoined, in the same melancholy music of voice. And Margrave then, leaning his arm upon her shoulder, as he had leaned it on mine, drew her away from the group into a neighboring copse of the flowering eucalypti mystic trees, never changing the hues of their pale green leaves, ever shifting the tints of their ash-gray, shedding bark. For some moments I gazed on the two human forms, dimly seen by the glinting moonlight through the gaps in the foliage. Then turning away my eyes, I saw, standing close at my side, a man whom I had not noticed before. His footstep, as it stole to me, had fallen on the sward without sound. His dress, though oriental, differed from that of his companions, both in shape and color fitting close to the breast, leaving the arms bare to the elbow, and of a uniform ghastly white, as are the cerements of the grave. His visage was even darker than those of the Syrians or Arabs behind him, and his features were those of a bird of prey. The beak of the eagle, but the eye of the vulture. His cheeks were hollow, the arms, crossed on his breast, were long and fleshless. Yet in that skeleton form there was a something which conveyed the idea of a serpent's suppleness and strength. And as the hungry, watchful eyes met my own startled gaze, I recoiled impulsively with that inward warning of danger which is conveyed to man, as to inferior animals, in the very aspect of the creatures that sting or devour. At my movement the man inclined his head in the submissive Eastern salutation, and spoke in his foreign tongue, softly, humbly, fawningly, to judge by his tone and his gesture. I moved yet farther away from him with loathing, and now the human thought flashed upon me. Was I, in truth, exposed to no danger in trusting myself to the mercy of the weird and remorseless master of those hirelings from the East, 7 men in number, 2 at least of them formidably armed, and docile as bloodhounds to the hunter, who has only to show them their prey? But fear of man like myself is not my weakness. Where fear found its way to my heart, it was through the doubts or the fancies in which man like myself disappeared in the attributes, dark and unknown, which we give to a fiend or a specter. And, perhaps, if I could have paused to analyze my own sensations, the very presence of this escort creatures of flesh and blood lessened the dread of my incomprehensible tempter. Rather, 100 times, front and defy those 7 Eastern slaves I, haughty son of the Anglo-Saxon who conquers all races, because he fears no odds, than have seen again on the walls of my threshold the luminous, bodiless shadow. Besides, Lillian, for one chance of saving her life, however wild and chimerical that chance might be, I would have shrunk not a foot from the march of an army. Thus reassured and thus resolved, I advanced, with a smile of disdain, to meet Margrave and his veiled companion, as they now came from the moonlit copse. Well, I said to him, with an irony that unconsciously mimicked his own, have you taken advice with your nurse? I assume that the dark form by your side is that of Aisha. *, Margrave's former nurse and attendant. The woman looked at me from her sable veil, with her steadfast, solemn eyes, and said, in English, though with a foreign accent, the nurse born in Asia is but wise through her love, the pale son of Europe is wise through his art. The nurse says, forbear. *, do you say, adventure? Peace! Exclaimed Margrave, stamping his foot on the ground. I take no counsel from either. It is for me to resolve, for you to obey, and for him to aid. Night is come, and we waste it. Move on. The woman made no reply, nor did one. He took my arm and walked back to the hut. The barbaric escort followed. When we reached the door of the building, Margrave said a few words to the woman, and to the litter bearers. They entered the hut with us. Margrove pointed out to the woman his coffer, to the men the fuel stowed in the outhouse. Both were borne away, and placed within the litter. Meanwhile I took from the table, on which it was carelessly thrown, the light hatchet that I habitually carried with me in my rambles. "Do you think that you need that idle weapon?" said Margrove. "Do you fear the good faith of my swarthy attendants? Nay, take the hatchet yourself. Its use is to sever the gold from the quartz in which we may find it embedded, or to clear, as this shovel, which will also be needed, from the slight soil above it, the ore that the mine in the mountain flings forth, as the sea casts its waves on the sands. Give me your hand, fellow laborer," said Margrove, joyfully. "Ah, there is no faltering terror in this pulse. I was not mistaken in the man. What rests, but the place and the hour? I shall live, I shall live." 3. Margrove now entered the litter, and the veiled woman drew the black curtains round him. I walked on, as the guide, some yards in advance. The air was still, heavy, and parched with the breath of the Australasian Sirocco. We passed through the meadow lands, studded with slumbering flocks. We followed the branch of the creek, which was linked to its source in the mountains by many a trickling waterfall. We threaded the gloom of stunted, misshapen trees, gnarled with the stringy bark which makes one of the signs of the strata that nourish gold. And at length the moon, now in all her pomp of light, mid-heaven among her subject stars, gleamed through the fissures of the cave, on whose floor lay the relics of antediluvian races, and rested in one flood of silvery splendor upon the hollows of the extinct volcano, with tufts of dank herbage, and white spaces of paler sward, covering the gold below gold, the dumb symbol of organized matter's great mystery, storing in itself, according as mind, the informer of matter, can distinguish its uses, evil and good, bane and blessing. Hitherto the veiled woman had remained in the rear, with the white-robed, skeleton-like image that had crept to my side unawares with its noiseless step. Thus, in each winding turn of the difficult path at which the convoy following behind me came into sight, I had seen, first, the two gaily dressed, armed men, next the black, bear-like litter, and last the black-veiled woman and the white-robed skeleton. But now, as I halted on the tableland, backed by the mountain and fronting the valley, the woman left her companion, passed by the litter and the armed men, and paused by my side, at the mouth of the moonlit cavern. There for a moment she stood, silent, the procession below mounting upward laboriously and slow. Then she turned to me, and her veil was withdrawn. The face on which I gazed was wondrously beautiful, and severely awful. There was neither youth nor age, but beauty, mature and majestic as that of a marble Demeter. "Do you believe in that which you seek?" she asked in her foreign, melodious, melancholy accents. "I have no belief," was my answer. "True science has none. True science questions all things, takes nothing upon credit. It knows but three states of the mind: denial, conviction, and that vast interval between the two which is not belief, but suspense of judgment." The woman let fall her veil, moved from me, and seated herself on the crag above that cleft between mountain and creek, to which, when I had first discovered the gold that the land nourished, the rain from the clouds had given the rushing life of the cataract, but which now, in the drought and the hush of the skies, was but a dead pile of stones. The litter now ascended the height. Its bearers halted. A lean hand tore the curtains aside, and Margrove descended leaning, this time, not on the black-veiled woman, but on the white-robed skeleton. There, as he stood, the moon shone full on his wasted form, on his face, resolute, cheerful, and proud, despite its hollowed outlines and sickly hues. He raised his head, spoke in the language unknown to me, and the armed men and the litter-bearers grouped round him, bending low, their eyes fixed on the ground. The veiled woman rose slowly, and came to his side, motioning away, with a mute sign, the ghastly form on which he leaned, and passing round him silently, instead, her own sustaining arm. Margrove spoke again a few sentences, of which I could not even guess the meaning. When he had concluded, the armed men and the litter bearers came nearer to his feet, knelt down, and kissed his hand. They then rose, and took from the bier-like vehicle the coffer and the fuel. This done, they lifted again the litter, and again, preceded by the armed men, the procession descended down the sloping hillside, down into the valley below. Margrove now whispered, for some moments, into the ear of the hideous creature who had made way for the veiled woman. The grim skeleton bowed his head submissively, and strode noiselessly away through the long grasses. The slender stems trampled under his stealthy feet, relifting themselves as after a passing wind. And thus he too sank out of sight down into the valley below. On the tableland of the hill remained only we three, Margrove, myself, and the veiled woman. She had reseated herself apart, on the gray crag above the dried torrent. He stood at the entrance of the cavern, round the sides of which clustered parasitical plants, with flowers of all colors, some among them opening their petals, and exhaling their fragrance only in the hours of night, so that, as his form filled up the jaws of the dull arch, obscuring the moonbeam that strove to pierce the shadows that slept within, it stood now wan and blighted as I had seen it first, radiant and joyous, literally framed in blooms. "Ivy, so," said Margrove, turning to me, "under the soil that spreads around us lies the gold which to you, and to me is at this moment of no value, except as a guide to its twin, born the regenerator of life. You have not yet described to me the nature of the substance which we are to explore, nor the process by which the virtues you impute to it are to be extracted. Let us first find the gold, and instead of describing the life amber, so let me call it, I will point it out to your own eyes. As to the process, your share in it is so simple, that you will ask me, why I seek aid from a chemist. The life amber, when found, has but to be subjected to heat and fermentation for 6 hours. It will be placed in a small cauldron which that coffer contains, over the fire which that fuel will feed. To give effect to the process, certain alkalies and other ingredients are required. But these are prepared, and mine is the task to commingle them. From your science as chemist I need and ask not. In you I have sought only the aid of a man. If that be so, why, indeed, seek me at all? Why not confide in those swarthy attendants, who doubtless are slaves to your orders? Confide in slaves, when the first task enjoined to them would be to discover, and refrain from purloining gold. 7 such unscrupulous knaves, or even one such, and I, thus defenseless and feeble. Such is not the work that wise masters confide to fierce slaves. But that is the least of the reasons which exclude them from my choice, and fix my choice of assistant on you. Do you forget what I told you of the danger which the dervish declared no bribe I could offer, could tempt him a second time to brave? I remember now, those words had passed away from my mind. And because they had passed away from your mind, I chose you for my comrade. I need a man by whom danger is scorned. But in the process of which you tell me I see no possible danger, unless the ingredients you mix in your cauldron have poisonous fumes. It is not that. The ingredients I use are not poisons. What other danger, except you dread your own eastern slaves? But, if so, why lead them to these solitudes? And, if so, why not bid me be armed? The eastern slaves, fulfilling my commands, wait for my summons, where their eyes cannot see what we do. The danger is of a kind in which the boldest son of the East would be more craven, perhaps, than the daintiest sybarite of Europe, who would shrink from a panther and laugh at a ghost. In the creed of the dervish, and of all who adventure into that realm of nature which is close to philosophy and open to magic, there are races in the magnitude of space unseen as animalcules in the world of a drop. For the tribes of the drop science has its microscope. Of the host of yon azure infinite magic gains sight, and through them gains command over fluid conductors that link all the parts of creation. Of these races, some are wholly indifferent to man, some benign to him, and some deadly hostile. In all the regular and prescribed conditions of mortal being, this magic realm seems as blank and tenantless as yon vacant air. But when a seeker of powers beyond the root functions by which man plies the clockwork that measures his hours, and stops when its chain reaches the end of its coil, strives to pass over those boundaries at which philosophy says, knowledge ends then, he is like all other travelers in regions unknown. He must propitiate, or brave the tribes that are hostile, must depend for his life on the tribes that are friendly. Though your science discredits the alchemist's dogmas, your learning informs you that all alchemists were not ignorant impostors. Yet those whose discoveries prove them to have been the nearest allies to your practical knowledge, ever hint in their mystical works at the reality of that realm which is open to magic, ever hint that some means less familiar than furnace and bellows are essential to him who explores the elixir of life. He who once quaffs that elixir, obtains in his very veins the bright fluid by which he transmits the force of his will to agencies dormant in nature, to giants unseen in the space. And here, as he passes the boundary which divides his allotted and normal mortality from the regions, and races that magic alone can explore, so, here, he breaks down the safeguard between himself and the tribes that are hostile. Is it not ever thus between man and man? Let a race the most gentle, and timid and civilized dwell on one side a river or mountain, and another have home in the region beyond. Each, if it pass not the intervening barrier, may with each live in peace. But if ambitious adventurers scale the mountain, or cross the river, with design to subdue and enslave the population they boldly invade, then all the invaded arise in wrath, and defiance the neighbors are changed into foes. And therefore this process by which a simple, though rare material of nature is made to yield to a mortal the boon of a life which brings, with its glorious resistance to time, desires and faculties to subject to its service beings that dwell in the earth and the air, and the deep has ever been one of the same peril which an invader must brave when he crosses the bounds of his nation. By this key alone you unlock all the cells of the alchemist's lore. By this alone understand how a labor, which a chemist's crudest apprentice could perform, has baffled the giant fathers of all your Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.